Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Good morning. Welcome to First Things First. I'm Jenna Wolf. That's Nick Wright. Danny Cannell is with us this morning. Good morning, Danny.
That's on brand, Danny.
There we go. That's right.
Turtleneck brand.
Hey, it's a cold, rainy day out. The turtleneck just like snuggly. Oh, you know, you just like want to just cozy up with it and just
keep
relax.
Keep cashing them checks. keep cashing them checks.
It is a rainy and miserable day in New York, so get
it's
cozy.
It's a great day. It's
stay
a great day.
In. Call out sick and watch us for 3 hours. Big show for you on this Tuesday morning, and we have to start with history made on Monday Night Football. Drew Brees and the Saints hosting the Colts, and what a game for Brees. Third quarter, he finds his tight end, Josh Hill, for a touchdown, not just any touchdown, the record-breaking one, which moves him past Peyton Manning for most passing touchdowns all time at 540. He got love from his teammates, from his family, from the fans there in New Orleans. Brees finished the night an incredible 29 of 30. That is a 96.7 completion percentage, best mark ever in a single game. And a win to top it all off for the Saints. Here's Drew Brees after the game.
Listen, it was special. Everything about the night, you know. I don't know how they pick them, right? Monday Night Football, playing the Colts, right? The team that, you know, we won the Super Bowl against 10 years ago. So the whole Super Bowl 44 team is back for the 10th anniversary, and obviously national television, you know, big game, and now, you know, that record in the balance as well, and just kind of makes you shake your head, you know, just, are you kidding me? You know, I'm not sure how we got here. it just, you know, kind of makes your whole life and career flash before your eyes.
Colts were like, anything we can do to help you, no problem.
Yes. Drew Brees. Did you see Alex, his exposed neck? It was just uncomfortable.
Oh. Like
I don't know what that t-shirt was. Oh. He would have looked
but
much better
on,
in a turtleneck.
Had
see?
My blazer. He
looked
That's
good. Right. Yeah. That's right.
All right, Nick, let's talk about Drew Brees, and then we'll get to where the Saints are right now. Where does Brees rank right now all time among quarterbacks?
Well, it's such an interesting question because we talked about this a little over a year ago when Brees passed, I think it was Peyton Manning, maybe 2 years ago actually, on the passing yards list. And you can, statistically, he has the profile of one of the two or three greatest quarterbacks ever. He's got more touchdowns than anybody now, more yards than anybody, more completions than anybody. So the three things quarterbacks can do, complete passes for yards, and then complete passes for touchdowns, he's done more of that than any quarterback ever. He and Brady might catch him in touchdowns. It'll depend on who plays longer. But he, Brady, Peyton Manning, and Favre are basically the top of the mountain statistically across almost all statistical categories. But Brees isn't in that class quite. And even with another Super Bowl, I don't think he'd be in that class because there's one thing that the other modern day all-time greats have, which is a period of time where we all thought, oh, that's the best quarterback in football. And Brees, despite his brilliance, and his story is unbelievable, this is a guy who won comeback player of the year, not coming back from injury, coming back from being bad. He got benched in 2003 for Doug Flutie, and in 2004 he wins the NFL Comeback Player of the Year award. He then in 2006 has to go to a new team because in the first 4 or 5 years of his career, he only had one outstanding season. And starting in 2006 to now, that's when he's gone on this unbelievable run. But if you're talking about modern era quarterbacks, there's obviously Brady right here.
Yep.
But then that next tier to me, Peyton Manning, Joe Montana, John Elway, not only do all those guys have multiple Super Bowls, but all those guys at one period of their career were the clear-cut best quarterback in the league. That next tier, I think, is where Breeze is, along with Aaron Rodgers, Brett Favre, Dan Marino. But even those guys all have one thing Breeze doesn't: a league MVP, multiple first-team All-Pros. So it's really difficult to slot him. It's almost, to cross sports, a Ricky Henderson situation. You know what, where you're talking about? Or even maybe Hank Aaron's a better example. I don't think anyone talks about Hank as the greatest baseball player ever, but you look at the numbers and you're like, why is he not in the discussion? Because he was probably never the best player playing at that time. So I'm not trying to take anything away from Drew, but that's, to me, he's on that third tier of modern greats, which is nothing against him. It's ahead of Big Ben. It's ahead of our friend Troy Aikman. It's ahead of some other guys, but it's not with Peyton Manning. It's not with Joe Montana. It's certainly not with Tom Brady.
So I had him at top five all time, but I do think it's modern era quarterbacks because we are living in a new age. And I even think if you went back and pinpointed it to 2004, 2005, when you saw the pass interference rule change, which really was the Peyton Manning rule, like the NFL Competition Committee, which Bill Polian was a part of, and you know, had to say, hey, he had four interceptions the AFC Championship game. They changed the rule. All of a sudden, that's when you really saw an explosion in the passing stats in the NFL. So you really almost have to look at everybody a little bit differently, because these numbers, as insane as they are, these are all going to be broken down the road, because Patrick Mahomes, like, in longevity does become come into play here. But I also feel like you love LeBron, and the one thing LeBron doesn't have to catch MJ is the rings. So I want to make sure we don't do that with Drew Brees, because he only has one ring. Like, we're going to hold that against him. And I think that's an easy thing to fall victim to, is that all of a sudden you say, well, he's never been that. And the fact that while he was playing, Peyton Manning was ringing up five MVPs. Well, neither one of us would make the case for him over Peyton Manning, but he's sure got to be right there with him.
But let me ask you that, because let's just say the Saints win the Super Bowl this year.
Right, then he'd match him,
just
too.
Give it to him.
Yep.
He's obviously not Brady, right?
No.
He's still obviously not Peyton Manning, even though they'd have the same number of Super Bowls. He beat Peyton in a Super Bowl, and he has all the records. I still think eye test-wise, when those two guys were playing, they played in the same era, Peyton was better, right?
Yes.
Joe Montana, to me,
I have him over.
John Elway, who went to 5-1-2, and his numbers are a guy who's an example. The numbers aren't there. Right. So there's four modern era guys already.
But see, I don't have Elway ahead of Drew Brees, because I look at the way some of these guys played. That's why I have an irrational reverence for Dan Marino.
Sure.
Because I grew up down there. I was friendly with him. Got to know him. So I might be a little bit too loyal to Dan Marino. But if you look at the lack of weapons that he had, didn't have a run game, and they really relied heavily on the pass. Like, if John Elway didn't get Terrell Davis at the end of his career, he doesn't get those Super Bowls, and we might not talk about him the same way.
So, you know what I mean? But if you have Marino up there, but that would mean Brees, because top five, the thing about top fives is there's only five people.
Right.
So Brees,
I had him at five.
Brees,
I had
Marino. Ahead of Brett Favre,
yes.
Ahead of Aaron Rodgers, ahead of obviously Steve Young and Troy Aikman.
Yes.
Okay, so you've got him ahead of Elway. So you go Brady, Manning, Montana, Manning, either way. Marino.
I have Brady, Montana, Peyton Manning, Dan Marino, Drew Brees.
Yeah, and I think for all these discussions, we're almost better off doing tiers.
Tiers, you're right.
Because, like, I have him in the tier with Aaron Rodgers, Brett Favre, and Dan Marino, because then we end up arguing 4 versus 7 versus 6.
Right. So if it's about the eye test, or if it's about who's MVP, or if it's about who's the best quarterback at any one time, there
it
is.
How about that?
Should numbers not matter? Why are we even keeping stats then if it's not about it? Because if statistically, he's right there.
Well, so it's all of it, right? So it's, you know, for these discussions, it's partial winning, it's partial stats, and it's partial eye test. Drew Brees has done enough winning to get in the conversation.
Absolutely.
He hasn't done so much winning that it ends the conversation like with Brady, but he's done enough to get in the door. If you don't have any winning, then you have to, the eye test and the stats have to be so overwhelming, like Marino, you force your way in, right?
Yep.
With Elway, he did so much winning that it kind of overcomes the eye test part, or not the eye test, the stats part.
Right.
So he went to five Super Bowls. So it's kind of a what's the word? A combination is the word I'll use of all of it. His stats are an A triple plus. The eye test for me is very, very good, but he's just hurt by the fact that he came in right after Favre, who won three MVPs. Mm-hmm. He played during Rodgers, who's won multiple MVPs. Brady, who's won three MVPs. Peyton Manning, who's won five. So even things like all-pro teams, he's only been the first team all-pro quarterback once in his career, which is maybe it's the era is working against him. If he had come in the mid-80s, would it be different? I don't know. But that, to me, is always going to hurt him on this all-time rankings.
I think, too, the record that impresses me most, and this is a title he can have in his own right, the most accurate thrower of the football of all time. And that's backed up statistically, you know, with the completion percentage, he's going to go down with the highest career completion percentage, the single season completion percentage, and now the game completion percentage. That to me is a title that's worthy of its own category, and he's got that bar none. I'm telling you, Nick, Jenna, I played, you know, 7 years in the NFL and watched a lot of practices where you're just playing 7-on-7 with no defense on the field. And you had quarterbacks, starting quarterbacks, who couldn't complete 29 out of 30 passes with no defense. The fact that he did this, real live tackling taking place and guys running routes, it is absurd to be able to do this on that stage.
Against a team whose playoff life was on the line in Indy.
Who needed the win.
The Saints needed the win. And he knew he had this record hanging over his head that if he doesn't get it, Tom Brady could be the one getting the ceremony a week from now in that context. One of the things Drew Brees has, his story is one of the most unique in NFL history. Favre's story is very unique as well. But to be a second-round pick, to have your first team say, we like you, but we're going to go with Phillip Rivers. To have the Miami Dolphins pass on you because of an injury. To be benched in your first slate for Doug Flutie briefly. And then to go on this run. No one could have anticipated this coming when he teamed up with the New Orleans Saints and Sean Payton in 2006. And to be here right now is truly remarkable.
All right. All right, moving on. The Cleveland Browns suffered another loss Sunday, this time to Arizona. Among the many lowlights, another tough outing for Baker Mayfield, a sideline blow-up between Jarvis Landry and head coach Freddie Kitchens, and now this, a recent report stating multiple Browns players, including Jarvis and Odell, yelled at the Arizona sideline to, quote, come get me after the game. Freddie Kitchens said he didn't care about his future as the Browns head coach. And yesterday, to walk that back.
Let me clarify, since I care about my job, all right? I only care, though, about getting better today. That's what I was trying to illustrate, is I'm only focused on today, on getting this football team to play the best of their ability today and to increase those chances of us getting to that point on Sunday. The only thing I was trying to illustrate is the fact that I'm only concerned about what we're doing as a football team today. All right, and that's it. Of course I want to be back.
Nick, why does it feel like the wheels are coming off this team as they inch closer to ending the season? Do you think the Browns should clean house and build again around Baker?
Well, yes, obviously they should clean house. And that means, I think clean house means fire the head coach. The general manager, John Dorsey, his job's going to be safe, but he's now on far more tenuous footing than anyone could have anticipated going into this year. Because one thing Dorsey, the best thing on his resume with the Browns was, I picked Baker Mayfield. That looked amazing a year ago. It obviously right now looks far more questionable, even if I still believe in Baker's ability to turn this around. But for the Browns, this has been the worst case scenario season. Baker looks terrible. More on that in a bit. The locker room does appear to officially be falling apart with the reports that Odell a month and a half ago was saying during the games in October, come get me to opponents. Jarvis now reportedly, according to Mike Silver, echoing those statements against the Arizona Cardinals. They don't have any direction. I mean, just a few weeks ago, the best player on their team thumped an opposing quarterback in the head with his helmet. That seems like it's a footnote. The head coach, of course, then wore the Pittsburgh Star-studded shirt. Like, all of this has been a comedy of errors for Cleveland. The only silver lining, Danny, is because they've lost two of their last three, because they are now de facto eliminated from the postseason, I believe they absolutely will move on from Freddie Kitchens, which is better for their long-term future than sneaking into the playoffs and keeping Freddie Kitchens, because he seems way in over his head, and that's where the house cleaning has to start.
I've been late to this party because I always try to give guys the benefit of the doubt, right? Say, hey, it's first year, maybe you can learn on the fly. You know, we've seen coaches survive rough starts and be able to accomplish great things, right? They come back from it. This, to answer your question, the wheels have come off. They're long gone. The car's on fire. You know, you're trying to put the fires out left and right. That's the perfect way to describe it, is somebody who's in over their head. And it shouldn't be that much of a surprise. The guy doesn't have much experience as a coordinator. He's been a position coach. And all of a sudden, they just, here you go. Here's the keys. And we should have listened to when some coaches that were on the staff said, you know what? A lot of the success that came last year wasn't really because of Freddie Kitchens. It was some of the other guys in that staff who are no longer there. You mentioned, you know, the Myles Garrett situation. You know, he's in charge of that.
Of course.
We've talked a lot about the discipline issues with penalties, you know, just stupid, foolish penalties. Those fall on the head coach. Like, what type of culture are you creating at practice? That carries over into games. You haven't been able to keep. Now, this might be a hard job to do, but it is his job to keep Odell Beckham happy, to keep Jarvis Landry happy, to keep your best players invested. He's lost them, clearly. Records aside, the exchange they just showed right there with Jarvis Landry, where he comes over there and, you know, see Baker, it is bad. And when you've lost the locker room, and I think that's where Freddie Kitchens is now, that to me is that the sign, it's over. You are done with, because you don't regain that trust and those relationships just like that. It takes time, and a lot of times it's the damage is done, and I think that's where they are now for the Browns. And it's the question then becomes, well, where do you go? You know, and I do think a college coach like a Lincoln Riley, but here's the thing, would you want this job? And he's got a really good job at Oklahoma, makes a lot of money. It's pretty close to what you can make in the NFL. But I think Baker Mayfield loved college. He still kind of has a college mentality when you see him, you know, talking about rivalries and calling out teammates who are going to leave in free agency when Duke Johnson was wanted to be traded. Like, that's a hard pill to swallow early in your career. You don't understand that. But you become a professional, you're like, that's part of the business. I still think Baker would thrive with a college-type coach. That's why I do think Lincoln Riley would be a good option. Urban Meyer was in Ohio, from Ohio. Like, I think he'd be a good option. But that's the one thing that kind of concerns me. What direction are you going to go after this? And that would be, you know, the third head coach for Baker Mayfield. That's a tough ask.
Do you think that our expectations were just a little too high for this team and that they bought into it, that they were a young team that maybe heard or listened more than they should have listened to what everyone was saying about them, how high everyone perched them before the season began? And there was just no way anyone was going to live up to those expectations.
Well, I agree with everything you said until the very end. I mean, they absolutely could have lived up to the expectations. You win 10 games. I mean, that's the expectations weren't they win the Super Bowl. The expectations weren't they be the best team in football. It was a team that went 7-8-1 last year with a horrible kicking situation and turnover at the head coach position and a rookie quarterback, get a couple games better. I don't think they were unrealistic expectations. They just failed on all fronts. And you can't succeed in this league with a bad head coach and with a quarterback playing the way Baker is. You could have any other combination. We can talk about Odell being underachieving, Jarvis being unhappy, the Myles Garrett suspension, the defense not being as good as I thought it would be. But ultimately, you could have the 85 Bears defense and the 0-1 Pat special teams. And if you have a head coach and quarterback combo right now that's playing, coaching the way Freddie Kitchens is, and show Baker's numbers. Baker has been a train wreck. He has been, by any estimation, one of the five worst everyday starters in the league this year. Can't win that way.
Nope.
Just flatly cannot win that way. So, now, did the expectations get to Baker? Possibly. He clearly was listening to the outside noise. There's no question about that. But Baker has been terrible this year. That has been a constant. Freddie Kitchens has shown no ability. There's no reason to believe he is prepared or qualified for this job. And by the way, his football resume up until 14 months ago said he was not prepared or qualified for this job. I wouldn't go Lincoln Riley. To me, that would be rewarding Baker. Like, Baker would love that. I hate to say this because I feel like it's the old man yelling from the porch, but Baker might need a little humbling. And this season, I think, has been humbling. And having a third head coach is not a good start for any quarterback, but Hugh was not his fault. I don't think Freddie's his fault. They just hired the wrong guy. Bringing in a Ron Rivera type, that's the, or Mike McCarthy. Who was mentioned last year because of the relationship with John Dorsey. Someone who has experience in this league. The reason I say Rivera is because then you're the quarterback and you're like, oh, the head coach is not being picked based on me. He's a defensive-minded coach. Pick the offensive coordinator based on Baker. Pick the head coach based on the organization. I'm not saying Lincoln Riley wouldn't be successful,
right,
but for this team, I don't know if it's what they need.
It's a mess, for sure. It is an absolute mess. I think Ron Rivera, be it out, somebody that brings some stability there. But you said Baker's, you know, humbled. He has to be, but has he learned? That's the thing. I don't know.
Like, will he spend the offseason maybe no commercials?
Not even the commercials, but has he learned the way to handle media, it was just 2 weeks ago he's throwing the medical staff under and, you know, calling out and talking about Odell's injury. Like, those are things you don't air out with the media. He got into a feud with a media member there in Cleveland not that long ago. He's been humbled somewhat, but has he truly learned what it takes to be a professional? I still think he has a long way to go.
Let's move on to LeBron James and the Los Angeles Lakers, sitting on the best record in the NBA at 24-3. And as a fun reminder, this is LeBron's 17th season, which makes the fact that he's leading the NBA in assists for the first time in his career that much more impressive. And oh, by the way, he's played in every game so far. Here's LeBron on the theme of this season, load management.
If I'm healthy, I play.
That's just going to be your approach all year.
I mean, that should be the approach. I mean, unless we're getting to, like, you know, late in the season and we've clinched and we can't get any better or any worse, and, you know, it could benefit from that. But, I mean, why wouldn't I play if I'm healthy? It doesn't make any sense to me, personally. I mean, I don't know how many games I got left in my career. I don't know how many kids that may show up to a game that they're to come see me play. And if I sit out, then what? You know, that's my obligation. My obligation is to play for my teammates. And if I'm healthy, then I'm going to play. If coach sits me out, then I'm not healthy. And it's just that simple.
A little dig at Kawhi there during the press conference. You think, Nick, that LeBron should take a page out of Kawhi's book and consider load management with where he is in his career and how hard he's been going so far this season?
No. Kawhi's book is its own book and needs to be, I mean, you said it, the theme of the season has been load management because of one guy. And it's hurt the standing of the league. It's hurt television ratings. I think for the average fan, they think the whole league's engaging in this when they're not. It's one guy who happens to be the reigning finals MVP. LeBron's approach is, of course, the correct one and has been his approach throughout his career. Aside from last year, where he suffered a major injury, there's only been one season where LeBron missed major time. His first year back in Cleveland, where he missed a two-week stretch dealing with a knee injury. Now, it became a bit of a punchline because while he was dealing with it, he went to see Ohio State win the national title, but he missed 8 games in a row dealing with a knee injury. Other than that, LeBron plays 76 games a year at a minimum every year. That's what he's done for the better part of 17 years. The team that invented load management, the Spurs, with Tim Duncan played 74 and 77 games in years 17 and 18. Dirk Nowitzki played 77 games in year 20. The initial load management was, you don't have to play all 82. It's foolish to play when we're on our third game in 4 nights and you're a long-term veteran and you might have a bit of a lingering something. Take the night off. There is no extra machismo and I've got to play all 82. But the idea that we would go from where it was, you should play 80 plus, to where it became, which is 75 is a reasonable number, to Kawhi's missed 8 of 28. He's missed a higher percentage than last year when he only played 60 games. It would be devastating for the sport if other people took this approach. And Danny, I appreciate what LeBron said at the end there, where he said, I don't know what little kid came to see me play. If you watched them play in Atlanta, wasn't a little kid. It was a grown man right behind the Lakers bench in a LeBron jersey, ostensibly from Atlanta. They play there once a year. He probably bought those tickets 4 months ago. And if LeBron that night, even as a grown-up, for that fan who is what makes all this possible, if LeBron says, I'm taking the night off, that's That's the worst moment of the guy's sports year instead of the best. He understands his responsibility to the league in a way that the vast majority of our superstars also do. One happens not to.
This might be one of the favorite things I've ever heard come out of his mouth, because I think it is sending a message league-wide. And I do think this was more problematic a few years ago when it was kind of becoming a status symbol. Oh, I'm good enough. I can sit over here, take the night off. I can, you know, load manage. I can take a rest and I can do that. You'd sit over there in the, you know, in your nice looking suit. It would be a status symbol. It was kind of a cool thing to do.
And what you're talking about was it was a really tough spot for the league because the two best teams in the West, the Spurs, who were the first team to do it, and then the Warriors, when they had KD, knew they were just going to coast through the regular season. So you had the two best teams in the Premier Conference, both teams engaging in it, which is where it really started to catch hold.
And then Adam Silver sends a stern message to the league, which everybody pretty much abided by except for Kawhi Leonard. But ultimately where we've come now is where Adam Silver can do he can try to do everything. He can try to send letters. He can try to send warnings. He can try to send messages. It has to come from the players themselves that realize for the health of the game, we need to go out there and we need to play when we're capable of playing. And it can't become a thing. It can't be a status symbol. And that's where I appreciate LeBron as the face and the voice of the NBA, sending a message to every player out there that might be considering this. If he can do it, then I can too. Because that's really where the message has to come from. It has to come from the players. And if LeBron's out there voicing that message, it's going to resonate throughout the league.
LeBron is much more of a team ambassador, a league ambassador than Kawhi is. All Kawhi really cares about is, can I be there for my team? Or, you know, what about winning the title for this team right now, whatever it takes. And LeBron cares about the integrity of the league and people coming to watch him and all of it. It's a much bigger conversation with him.
I agree with the LeBron point. The Kawhi thing, we'll see. I mean, you know what would have helped the Clippers? If they had beaten the Bulls the other night in a three-point loss when Kawhi sat out his eighth game of 28 games. So I understand that what we've decided with Kawhi, which is the whole reason this is a conversation this year, that no, what he's doing is actually the selfless thing, and some other shows will discuss, is LeBron being selfish by playing? Is he stat chasing? Is he doing these things? As opposed to, you show up to work when you're healthy to play. To show up to work, which has been the constant in all work, is sports or otherwise, since work. Since we were hunter-gatherers, if you can hunt and gather, you go do it.
And you get an off-season, you have off days, there are times
to
rest. And
nobody's saying you got to be all 82. No. Nobody's arguing.
Back to the NFL now. The Chiefs picked up their fourth straight win Sunday against the Denver Broncos, a pretty dominant win in a blinding snowstorm. And while they have had their struggles, the injuries, that defense, they are two wins away from the exact same record that they posted last season. When asked if he likes the Chiefs getting slept on, reigning MVP Pat Mahomes said, quote, "I think I do." Danny, you think people are sleeping on Mahomes and the Chiefs this year?
I absolutely do, especially considering coming into this season, they were the odds-on favorite to win the Super Bowl. And what's changed? Like, I don't know. Like, it's the same roster. They got the same pieces there. I get it. Mahomes was hurt for a couple weeks, and he had an injury. But as he continues to get healthier, this team is a force to be reckoned with. And you saw what he did in the weather this past weekend against Denver. Didn't faze him one bit.
At all.
He's got so much natural talent. They have weapons on the offensive side of the ball. And I know the defense is still a concern, but I don't think it's a significant reason why you should be, this team can't win the Super Bowl. Their defense statistically is better than Green Bay's and better than Seattle Seahawks. And we talk about them as potential Super Bowl candidates. Why can't we talk about the Chiefs that way?
And neither Green Bay nor Seattle has the offensive firepower. Kansas
Not even
City.
Close.
Big difference last year. I feel like I said this a month ago. Last year, the Chiefs were 12-4. Everyone loved them. This year, they're going to be 12-4. Everyone's out on them. Of course, last year, 12-4 was good enough for the one seed. This year, unless New England loses to Buffalo, they're going to be the three seed. So there is, I understand that significant difference. But the defense is playing far better right now than it did at any point last season. They just added Terrell Suggs, who's got 4 forced fumbles and 5.5 sacks this year. We'll see what impact he can make in place for the injured Alex Okafor. But dating back to week 7, Because the Chiefs were at their low point, I would say, after the back-to-back Indy and Houston losses. Mm-hmm. Indy, they played terribly. Houston, they gagged the game away. Here's what they've done since then. Denver, national television, watch their quarterback have his kneecap dislocated and annihilate them. Play Green Bay on national television with a backup quarterback. That game is 24 apiece in the fourth quarter. They beat Minnesota, a very good Vikings team, with a backup quarterback. And then the Titans game, a game they dominate for 58 and a half minutes and somehow invent a way to lose at the end. Then the defense plays great. They beat the Chargers. The offense and defense play great. They beat Oakland. They go to New England and beat them. And they just annihilated the Denver Broncos. They haven't had what I would consider a bad game of football since week 5 against Indy. And they are finally, for the first time all year, healthy. Of course, right now, the Ravens have been the best team in football. I think the Saints are the most complete team in the NFC. After those two teams, there is no team you can make to me the credible case you should have more faith in than the Kansas City Chiefs.
Back here, First Things First, now joined by former All-Pro running back Brian Westbrook. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
Good to see you.
Nice to see you.
How are we doing?
You.
Doing well.
Awesome.
On Sunday, Brian, the game we've all been waiting for all season, an NFC East showdown on Fox. Cowboys and Eagles from Philadelphia. Our guys at Fox Bet have the boys favored by 2.5. Nick, you buying the Cowboys as road favorites?
No, I'm not, and it's not because I'm super high on Philly. Philly's pulled one out of the fire in back-to-back weeks against back-to-back bad teams. I give Carson Wentz and the Eagles credit for not folding in those situations, but it's not like they all of a sudden look like they've gotten it right. And I understand the Cowboys just played their best and most complete game of the season, but this is a drastic overreaction to the Cowboys for once all year looking at their best, looking the way a lot of people thought they could throughout the season. And I know there is going to be the narrative of, well, are they peaking at the right time? You cannot be peaking if you were just at your lowest moment. The Cowboys 3 weeks prior to their great game against the Rams, it's not like they were on the cusp of putting it all together. They played a great defensive game and then a great offensive game. And then no, they played terribly against Buffalo and then followed that up by playing even worse against the Bears. So no, I'm not buying the Cowboys as road favorites over a team with a pulse, and the Eagles at the very least have that. And I'm not buying the Cowboys as all of a sudden some now dark horse contender if they get into the tournament, even though, Brian, Philly has had considerable struggles this year along with the Dallas Cowboys.
I'm actually buying the Cowboys as road favorites, and here's the reason. When Zeke plays, which he will this week, the Cowboys are 5-0 against the Eagles. Yep. Zeke has gone off against the Philadelphia Eagles, and the Eagles' defense has not looked very good as of late. Here's the thing, though. When they played each other week 5 or 6, whenever it was, the Philadelphia Eagles had 4 turnovers. The Dallas Cowboys converted 4 of those, 3 of those turnovers into touchdowns. Those are big stats. And so if the Eagles just say to me, we can go out there and not turn the football over, we're in the game. That means that Carson Wentz, who's come from behind these last 2 weeks, has an opportunity to helpfully win these games. I still think, even as a underdog, the Eagles have an opportunity to win this football game. But the big three for the Dallas Cowboys, that's the most important part. How can you slow down the big three, Cooper, Dak, as well as Zeke?
I got a little Christmas budget set aside for my daughters. I'm putting it on this game. On the Eagles, yeah, as the home dog there. So my daughters will have the best Christmas they've had in a long time.
Or
none of the other. I think you hit a spot, nail on the head. I think people are buying into, hey, the Cowboys have figured out. I think they might have, but I need to see a bigger body of work than one game where they kind of capture all this magic. And it was great. It was awesome. But I need to see this. Those 3 games, that 3 game skid, I need to see. By the way, 2 of which were on the road in nasty conditions where it looked like, oh, this is a team from Dallas where it's typically warmer, or they can, you know, play in a nice controlled environment as opposed to them having to go on the road. And I get where Zeke is playing, and they're 5-0 with Ezekiel Elliott, But how do we know which Jason Garrett is going to be calling plays? Is he going to feed him the rock enough times, or is he going to get away from it? Are they going to try to get cute at different times? I haven't seen enough consistency from this Dallas Cowboys to have enough confidence to say, you know what? They can lay 2.5 points, go on the road, and do it in Philly with a playoff type of atmosphere. I can't buy into that just yet.
Nick, what's on the line for this game? The Cowboys can clinch with a win, right?
Cowboys clinch the division if they win this football game. The Eagles, if they win this game, they don't clinch, but they're in obviously dominating position if they win the game. So, I mean, the winner of this game, if the Cowboys win it, 100% they win the division. If the Eagles win it, I'd say it's close to 90% they win the division.
We talk so much on this show about trust. Who do you trust more? And it's hard to trust either of these teams because of the inconsistent season both teams have had all season. But who do you trust more coming in? The team that showed you they can do it last week, or the team that...
I don't trust either of these teams. Philly's at home.
Yeah.
Philly's, and I understand home field in the NFL this year hasn't meant as much as it has in years past, particularly on the gambling side of things. I get that part of it. But I also think that we say Dallas finally put it all together. Okay, in the game they put it all together, they botched the coin toss and the opening kickoff. So, like, they did put it all together eventually after they screwed up the two easiest parts of the game.
I forgot it kicked it out of bounds.
I mean, you botched the coin toss. The New York and Al Riveron parachute in to save you, even though Dak screwed that up. That was not the official's fault. And then your new kicker kicks it out of bounds. There has not been at any level of consistency from Dallas this year, except for the fact that in the first 3 weeks of the year against horrible teams, they looked great. And I do wonder if how great the passing attack looked those first few weeks, Brian, tricked either Kellen Moore or the team as a whole into thinking they were something that they weren't, which is not a run-oriented, Ezekiel Elliott-centric team. Instead, Zeke being one of Dak's weapons, which is the way they treated the next 2 months of football, which I think led to a lot of their mediocrity.
Well, that's a concern I have for the Philadelphia Eagles. They may have been confused about whether they were going to be a passing team or a running team, but last week they understood exactly who they were going to be. They had Zeke going as well as Tony Pollard. Yep. Both of those guys had over 100 rushing yards. And the other concern is the Philadelphia Eagles defense. They got 37 points put up on them by the Miami Dolphins, 17 points by the Giants, and 27 points by a rookie quarterback in Dwayne Haskins, who everybody has taken advantage of. And so now I'm saying, here comes Amari Cooper, here comes Dak, here comes Zeke, here comes Tony Pollard. They're going to try to run the ball down their throat. And this is what they're saying, if you're Kellen Moore, we're going to run the ball until they stop it. When they stop it, now we have the ability to pass over the top with Dak finding Amari Cooper, who the DBs for the Philadelphia Eagles have not been able to stop receivers. They haven't been able to tackle very well. Michael Gallup going over top. Those are big-time things for the Eagles, and defensively, they have not been very good.
I think we're given – obviously, I think there's going to be an overreaction to what the Cowboys done. And I think what the Eagles have done, and I know they're against bad teams, but we're talking about career-defining moments for Carson Wentz coming back from 17-3, and I know it's the Giants. I know it's not very impressive. A career, you know, a game-winning drive against the Redskins, and I know it's the Redskins, but those types of moments can build up confidence in teammates, in him, in his own – in himself, that can resonate and that they can carry over some momentum too into this game, where maybe they start playing better from the time of the kickoff as opposed to waking up at halftime.
Are we confident Kellen Moore has now decided he's going to change the game plan to run the ball, even though the Eagles are terrible against the run? Are we confident Kellen Moore is going to go against what he did the whole first half of the season?
Well, I think the game plan against the Eagles has been consistent. Run the football. When you have Zeke, they've been 5-0. They've run the football every single time they played the Eagles, including earlier this season. I don't see that changing. You might change it against different teams, but against the Eagles, they run the football.
Well, and Zeke's averaging around 165 yards from scrimmage in his 5 career games against Philly. As you mentioned, they're undefeated in those games. I'm not trying to make the case that Dallas can't win this game. I'm trying to make the case they are the same team today they were last Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And last Tuesday, they were a flawed, underachieving team because they all of a sudden put it all together for a week against a different flawed, underachieving team in the loss. The Rams this week, this past week, are where the Cowboys are right now. A team that had been underachieving, for the Rams it was 2 games, for Dallas it was 1, played 2 really good games. It's like, oh, are the Rams back? Could the Rams be a dangerous? No, actually, they're not even going to make the postseason, and next year they're in real trouble. Dallas, after us, everyone being down on them, they do it for 1 week. It's like, oh, Cowboys, nobody wants to face them in the first round of the playoffs. Everybody wants to face them in the first
round
of the
playoffs. And to your point, they interviewed Jared Goff before the game on Sunday, and he said, yeah, look, we had adversity, but we figured it out. Yeah. We came out the other end.
And then
you
got punched in the mouth. Exactly. And listen, the Eagles, by the way, are in a similar boat, which is why the Cowboys can obviously win this game. But these teams are who they have shown us they are. There is not some midseason transfer coming. There's not some player coming off injury that's going to save the day. They're average football teams.
Can I make a public apology right here
to
Carson Wentz? Because we did his highlight, the throw that he whizzed past to Miles Sanders in the back end zone. I kind of downplayed it. I went back and watched it last night. That throw was insane. I did not give him enough credit, so I apologize, Carson Wentz. And if you notice, when he was scrambling, he kind of looked off the defense a little bit back towards the middle of the field.
We all noticed.
I didn't have my glasses on.
What was going on? It was a great play.
I apologize, Carson Wentz. It was insane.
Brian, you know things are bad when your head coach has to have multiple press conferences over the course of the season to talk about either T-shirts he should not have been wearing, right, things he should not have been. This is the head coach, by the way. What do you think the Browns should do? Should they clean house and start fresh by building around Baker?
No, you don't clean house. I mean, if you clean house, you're getting rid of two very talented receivers. You're getting rid of one of the better running backs
in the league. But talented to your team, though?
Yeah, but you need a better leader. That's what they need. All these things you're talking about, come get me, all those things, those are results of guys and teams losing. I've been on a team that it was losing in right after the Super Bowl. We were 6-10, and we had a lot of infighting in our football team. When you lose, everything goes wrong. Everything from your meal in the morning, from your lunch, from your dinner, everything is absolutely wrong. When you start winning, things change. And I think the attitudes on the sideline, what players are saying, will change as well. In order to do that, you got to get rid of Freddie Kitchens. That's just the answer. You need a better leader, a guy with more confidence, guys that. So here's the thing. If you respect your coach, you don't go yell at him like that on the sideline. You don't have that type of blow up on the sideline with your head coach. You just don't do it. Or if you do, after the game, you come to the media and say, I shouldn't have done that. I was out of line. You don't make that type of mistake. These guys don't respect Freddie Kitchens because he doesn't have the pedigree. He hasn't done it in the NFL. And because of that, these guys are wavered. They're all over the place. If you get a coach that gets in there, focuses your team, finds a way to get Baker to stop throwing the ball to the opposing team, then this is a different type of football team. You can win then, and then guys will want to be there. But right now, because of all the losing, everyone's going to be saying everything, and that happens on every team across the NFL.
Clearly, you want to build around Baker Mayfield. I mean, you drafted him for a reason, to make him your franchise quarterback. You've seen glimpses. You saw an entire rookie season where the future was bright. It was promising. Now you've had this regression, and I do think it focuses on the quarterback-coach relationship, and not only from a how do they get along, but how are they executing, more importantly, on the field. And there's just been a severe setback. You know, there's been a lot of film study and breakdowns of why isn't he putting me in better positions? Why aren't you utilizing Odell Beckham more? He's one of the most talented receivers in the game. And it has been an absolute disaster from that standpoint. I do think you do need to, and John Dorsey, because when you're the general manager, it's one thing to acquire talent, but you have to acquire the right talent for your locker room. There has to be a chemistry. There have to be guys that buy into your franchise and to their surroundings. And I think John Dorsey does need to have a sit down with Odell Beckham. I think Jarvis Landry is probably fine. He's over 1,000 yards. Like, right, he's still producing. But I think he needs to sit down to Odell Beckham and say, hey, I'm seeing these reports. I'm seeing, do you want out of here? Do you want out of here, or do you want to win here? Do you want to be a part of this rebuild? And if the answer is anything other than yes, then you have to shop
what
him.
You ask.
Well, but if he does, then you don't want him on your team. And then you try to trade him, bring in some pieces and people who actually want to be there.
What does clean house mean? Like,
it starts with the head coach.
So I think
starts with the disgruntled guys on the team who have shown they may want to be there, may not want to be there.
Yeah, so I think we all agree on the head coach.
Yeah,
The reason I asked the question is clean house, what it says on the screen, clean house and build around Baker. Building around Baker means giving him talented wide receivers, giving him talented players. The Browns have two flashing red light problems this year. None of them involve the kid formerly with the yellow hair. They are The head coach is in over his head, and the quarterback has been a disaster. Now, if people want to blame Baker's performance on the arrival of Odell Beckham, you can do that. I think you would look foolish doing that.
I don't think anyone's doing that.
No, 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 right. So the point being, Baker's stats this year are undeniably bad. You cannot win in this league. It is a coach-quarterback league with substandard coaching while also having substandard quarterback play. I would argue the Packers for a few years won with what I considered substandard coaching with great quarterback play. This year, the Patriots are winning with substandard quarterback play and great coaching. If you have both, you're a disaster. Right now, the Browns are a disaster. Baker has only two quarterbacks have more picks. He's 28th in completion percentage. He's 30th in passer rating. That's a disastrous season.
But you can't build this team around Odell. You have no choice but to build the team around Baker.
Of course. I'm not arguing you build it around Odell. What I'm saying is that we are searching for reasons why this has gone poorly for the Browns when it is very obvious. The coach is in over his head and the quarterback has regressed massively. It is John Dorsey's job to find the coach that can either hire a staff that can get Baker back on track or who individually can get Baker back on track. That is the answer to the questions here, is get the quarterback on the trajectory he was last year. You hired this coach because of that and that alone, and it's been a total failure to go along with all the other stuff that you're mentioning, the distractions caused by the head coach, which should never happen.
Even if you find a defensive coach, Ron Rivera, you need an offensive coordinator best, a quarterback coach that can get back to fundamentals for Baker. The thing I would do in Cleveland, it would be pretty simple. We're not going to depend on you to throw the ball 35, 40 times a game. We're going to run the ball 35 times with Nick Chubb. We're going to get you in some play action. We're going to want you to be more accurate than you've been in the past. We can't throw 17 touchdowns and then 17 interceptions. We're going to put you in a situation where now you can get the ball out of your hands. We want you to be a point guard instead of the scorer. We want you to be the guy that we can depend on to be accurate and down the field. That's it. We don't need you to win every football game. Right now, Baker has this thought process that he has to win every game for this team. That's not what he needs to be at this point.
It's Baker trying to do that, but it's also Freddie Kitchens trying to make everybody happy and feeding his big name wide receivers and hearing in his head constant report. We got to get Odell involved. And building game plans around trying to go out there and get Odell involved when maybe the best thing for the team is to give the ball to Chubb and let him run it.
And that's why he's over his head, because I think he's listening to all these different voices. But when you talk about cleaning house, you are, when you fire the head coach, you are cleaning, you're getting a new offensive coordinator, new defensive coordinator. You know, it's going to be, and you need two of the things you need. You need a new culture. Somebody's going to get a little more discipline. He's going to get a little more buy-in. And then, you know, offensively, defensively, you want a system that is going to elevate Baker Mayfield. Look at Jared Goff, his rookie season. It was, this guy's a bust. This guy's, what a waste of, you know, what waste of draft pick. Sean McVay comes in there, massive turnaround, Super Bowl, you know, appearance for Jared Goff, gets a new contract. You have to have somebody that's going to build a system that fits Baker Mayfield's skill set, whether it's the head coach or the offensive coordinator.
And someone who can teach Baker this year, as soon as you get the snap, don't just sprint to your right. Yes. Stand in the damn pocket and look down the field.
Right.
He looks scared for the first time in his whole career playing football. He looks scared and tentative this year. He never looked like that at Oklahoma. He did not look like that his rookie season.
Baker has to improve his skill set. At some point, his individual athletic ability got him past Oklahoma and early
He's
on in his career.
He's not a good athlete for the NFL.
He has to be a better skilled player. He can do that. He can change.
B-dubs, want to play a little in or out?
Let's do it.
Okay. Last night, Drew Brees led the Saints to their 11th win of the season on his historic night, but the Packers, Seahawks, 49ers all have 11 wins as well. Danny Cannell, you in or out on the Saints being the best team in the NFC?
I'm out. Man, do we fall in love with what we just saw. And it was impressive, and it was a great story for Drew Brees, but are we forgetting the defense giving up 49 points, was it? 48 to the San Francisco 49ers, including that game-winning drive. Garoppolo just went right down the field like it was not a big deal. I think the Seahawks are the team to beat from the NFC. I'm stuck with them from day one, and I'm sticking with them through thick and thin.
You know, I'm in. And I have been accused before of viewing something and loving whatever I saw last. And so I saw last night a Saints team that offensively looked unstoppable. They have the ability to run. Drew Brees looked better than he ever had. But defensively, I think they're getting things going. And I think that defense can win, especially if teams have to go through the Superdome.
It doesn't mean that I necessarily think this team's going to make the Super Bowl, because where the how the playoff seedings fall is critically important to that. But right now, they're the most complete team in the NFC. They went 5-0 without Drew Brees. They have a legitimate running game. You mentioned Michael Thomas, without question, one of the five best receivers in football. You said he might have the best hands
the
in
best
football.
Hands.
The defense, the only question I have for the Saints is they lost Rankins and Davenport along that defensive line. Didn't hurt them last night. Could it hurt them in the postseason? Possibly. But right now, they are the most complete team in the NFC, so I'm in.
All right, sticking with the Saints, a big reason for Drew Brees' success this past few seasons has been his star wideout, Michael Thomas. Thomas, just 11 catches shy now of breaking Marvin Harrison's record for most catches in a season with 143. Danny, you in or out on Thomas breaking the record this week?
I am in on this one. We've all documented how it's the only weapon, really, that Drew Brees has to go with. Plus, you got Malcolm Butler out for the season. Adoree Jackson's missed a couple games recently. Who knows if he's even going to play here for the Titans. So they've got some issues on the defensive side of the ball. I think he's going to get it.
I'm in as well. I think, you know, when you think about Drew Brees, you're saying he doesn't like the glory, things like that, but he always has his eyes on records. Mike Thomas gets this record next week. He's had 8 games with double-digit catches. This happens this coming week.
I'm out that it happens this week. I'm not quite as certain as all of you that it's going to happen at all, only because, I mean, if Marvin Harrison calls Michael Thomas and says, I don't want you to break my record, if I'm Michael Thomas, I'm listening to Marvin Harrison.
No,
I'll do whatever he says, but he would need 11 to do it this week, more likely in week 17 unless Marvin puts the call in.
He's done it 6 times this year, 11 or more catches, including last night.
Maybe I'm factoring in a Marvin Harrison math here that you guys are not, but I am out on it happening this week.
I gotcha.
All right, one in Rome. The Carolina Panthers will reportedly bench Kyle Allen for third-round rookie quarterback Will Greer, which now has some speculating that maybe the Panthers will indeed bring back Cam Newton next season. Danny, you in or out on Carolina bringing back Cam?
I've done like a full 180 on this one.
Oh,
because I was out on him earlier in the season saying maybe he's done.
His career.
I was in, yeah.
Yep.
And I still think that's a question because of his health. I think it's where is he health-wise. But if he's healthy, if he passes all the medical tests, he feels good enough to go. And the way things have transpired with Kyle Allen, I don't think Will Greer is going to be the answer either. He's cheap. Bring him back for one more year in Carolina. Bring in a coach who's going to utilize him and say, you know what? I'm going to buy into Cam Newton and see if you can give it a run. $20 million is a bargain in today's environment.
I'm in as well. You know, it's going to depend on his health. If he could come back healthy, I would just draft a young quarterback like you mentioned, but I would use Cam up as much as I could, allow this young quarterback to mature behind Cam, and then use your young quarterback in the next couple years.
I have not moved 180 degrees on this. I've stayed exactly where I've been the whole time. Everyone fell in love with Kyle Allen because of a 4-game winning streak. Guess what Kyle Allen turned into? Back into Kyle Allen, the guy who went to multiple colleges, the guy who went undrafted, the guy who was cut twice before he caught on with the Panthers. He obviously, when they said, in theory, moving on from Cam Newton, I sat here and told you they will be in the market for a quarterback again a year from now, guaranteed. They're now realizing that Kyle Allen couldn't even make it through the year before they're like, okay, he's not the answer. They're now to Will Greer. Of course you keep Cam Newton. All the narrative surrounding Cam has been as if he's a pending free agent. I would be anxious about giving Cam Newton a long-term contract extension or a new contract because of the injury stuff, but $20 million is Nick Foles' money in this league. Of course you keep Cam Newton. Of course I'm in.
Man, the narrative is changing on Cam Newton.
Yes. We're allowed to do that, right? I apologize to Carson Wentz before.
The correct narrative has stayed the exact same on Cam Newton all year long.
All right, the Cowboys picked up a big win Sunday over the LA Rams. It was their first win this season against a team with a winning record. After the game, Cowboys legend and Fox NFL analyst Troy Aikman, who hasn't shied away from criticizing this team this season, talked about just how dangerous Dallas can be.
This was their best team win, and I think Dak Prescott said it best. It was a very complimentary win, and I think the takeaway from this is that what we knew coming into the season, quite honestly, if this team is playing the way that they're capable of playing, we know that they can move the football really against anybody. We know that they have the ability defensively to just smother opponents, much like they did here tonight against the Los Angeles Rams. They can play with anybody, and that's why, as bad as the season has looked at times, it's not so far-fetched to think that they can't get hot at just the right time, and anything can happen. They just got to get in first. And that game next week against the Philadelphia Eagles obviously is a big start.
Just that. Just get in first, and then you should be all set. All right, Nick, do you think NFC front runners should be dreading the Dallas Cowboys in the playoffs?
No. I'd be the opposite of that, licking my chops. I'd be excited to play them. The Cowboys or Eagles, whoever wins this just mess of a division, is going to be the worst team in the postseason, neck and neck with whomever the last wild card out of the AFC is. Because if Pittsburgh might get in, and if Pittsburgh with Duck Hodges or Mason Rudolph's the quarterback, then you could argue, you know, an eye test. But of the 12 teams that gets in, Dallas, if they get in, is either going to be the 11th or 12th. You want to play that team. You would rather have a bye if you're one of the top four teams in the NFC. The next best thing is going to Dallas and whooping up on this football team. I heard what Troy said, which is peaking at the right time. Well, define peaking, because they were at the nadir. They were at the ultimate low point of their season the day before the Rams game, coming off three straight losses, where you, against New England, I didn't think they played that poorly, actually, against New England. The offense couldn't get anything going. They had the ridiculous tripping calls go against them, but who cares about it, because it actually benefited the Patriots, so let's not have an officiating controversy. And then, but Jerry Jones was angry about that game. And then he really should have been angry about the Bills game on Thanksgiving and should have been livid about the Bears game the following Thursday. You had 10 days to prepare for another team that I think was a little fraudulent, the Rams, that everyone's like, oh, are they peaking now? No, they are who they were through the first 12 weeks. The Cowboys are who they've been, Danny, through 14 weeks. A team with immense talent that has underachieved consistently, that's had six opportunities to put it all together against a good team and has done it precisely once. In order for them to go on this run, they would have to do it again next week against Philly and then again in the wild card weekend against either San Francisco or Seattle. It's not going to happen.
You make some excellent points,
but you are crazy.
Okay. You're crazy. Tell me a coach that would say, we're excited about having the opportunity to stop the number one ranked offense yards per game, the number one ranked offense yards per play, the number two passing offense, the third best on third downs. This offense is scary. Now, I get what you're saying, but if, and that's a big if they continue this momentum, and I might be sounding like I'm talking about both sides of my mouth because I kind of like the Eagles with the points, but if they somehow win the division and they play well these last two games, I guarantee you nobody wants to go to Dallas to face the type of weapons they have. They have a top-tier running back in Ezekiel Elliott. They have an MVP candidate. Remember at the beginning of the season, we were all in on Dak Prescott, who can make plays with his legs. He does present some problems. Amari Cooper is a top five wide receiver in the NFL as far as what the threat is to what he can do to you. That is a scary proposition. And oh, by the way, their defense is top 10 in a lot of categories. Coaches would be dreading having to go on the road to face that team.
All right, so let's look at the eight teams that we believe, let's just assume Dallas wins the division, are going to be division winners. You have Baltimore, New England, Houston, Kansas City, Dallas, New Orleans, Green Bay, and Seattle, right? So those are eight division winners. Let's just pretend the playoff format was the best team that doesn't win a division gets to pick which place they go to.
Right.
So San Francisco, you can pick of those eight.
Right.
Guess what their top pick is? Dallas.
But all right, so here, let's put it this way. But here,
of all the teams you could face, Dallas is the one you want to.
But put it this way. I think if it was the Eagles, they would say, sign us up. Let's go. We'll go to the Philadelphia. We don't care. I think with the Cowboys, they're more nervous saying, man, we're getting screwed by the system because we have to go on the road with 11 or 12
wins. Well, they shouldn't have to go
this team. I agree with you there. But I do think it makes them nervous. I do not think they want to play this Dallas Cowboys team.
Well, if they win Sunday, a team is going to have to play this Dallas Cowboys team.
I was all excited because I was like, Troy must have been watching first thing first when we said this, but that was after the game.
Yeah, it was after the game.
I might have stole it from him.
Thank you. you for listening to the First Things First podcast. Remember, leave us a review and tell us what you think. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and catch us on FS1 Monday through Friday, 6:30 a.m. Eastern.